This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Kathleen Harris. I know we talk all about this a lot, but talking about retirement planning is something Jim and I are constantly just pounding the table about on this program, and there's reasons why we do that. A couple months ago, we actually walked you through the 6 steps of doing a financial plan. Today, we're going to talk about those steps in more detail. And part of this is inspired by a column that was written by John Clements. He did an article in the Sunday Wall Street Journal about to retire, 3 big questions. And Jim will actually be having a conversation with him later on today. So again, stay tuned for more information about how to actually put together a plan for your financial future.
Now, since Lifetime Income is a program that we talk about navigating that transition into retirement, you often hear us mention having a plan. Well, why do we talk about plans all the time? Well, think of a roadmap. It helps to get you there. And not only once you get there, it helps you get you through it. Because, you know, for many of you, you may be ending up spending 1/4 of your adult lifetime into retirement. So today we're going to talk about, okay, we've talked about plans, but what goes into a plan? What are the kinds of information, the documents that need to be reviewed, the areas that need to be analyzed? And let's face it, it's probably one of the most important decisions in your life. As I mentioned, you could be spending almost 1/4 of your life between you, your partner, your spouse in retirement, whether you do that on a voluntary basis or you do it on an involuntary basis.
And Jim, I'm glad you mentioned that about involuntary versus voluntary. You know, we like to think we're in control of when we're going to retire and that having a plan is going to help us know when we're actually going to be able to afford to retire. And that's true. But some of us have actually experienced since 2008, particularly, that sometimes we don't always get to choose our retirement date. Sometimes our company chooses that date for us. And I have to say, Jim, one of the advantages of having a plan in place is that you have more of a sense of confidence in your overall retirement readiness, even when you're sort of going through an involuntary retirement process. You've already got all the information in place and it's easier for you to figure out, you know, do I need to go back to work? Am I just going to have to cut things back a little bit? So having a plan in place can really reduce the stress of going through an involuntary retirement situation because you kind of already know where you're going to go. You know what your sources of income are going to be and what it's going to take to get you there. So it's not quite as stressful. But I have to remind people, Jim, too, I'm not going to lie. Putting a financial plan in place, it's not a super fast process. It does take some time. And the reason why it takes time, Jim, is because there is just a lot of data that has to be pulled together. It is a very intensive data gathering process. You know, you always kind of compare it, Jim, to going into the doctor. The first time you go to a new doctor, they have you fill out what feels like a whole book about your medical history and your family's medical history and your friend's medical history, it feels like sometimes. And there's a reason why the doctor has you do that. It's because he can't adequately treat you if he doesn't know where you've been and what your situation is right now. It's the same thing with financial planning. When you're getting ready to do a financial plan, you're going to have to start thinking about things like pulling together your income taxes, all your bank statements, all your brokerage account statements, all of your insurance statements, all of your annuity statements. You're going to need to know what your medical expenses look like, not just your medical expenses, but what's your family's medical history, what's your family's longevity cycle like. What about your family? What's your family situation like right now? Is it going to change in the future? Are you going to support a parent, maybe support a kid for the rest of your lifetime? So there's a lot of information that needs to be gathered together. So what we wanted to do is actually describe the process of the important parts of getting this plan done. Your goals and your input are some of the first parts of the plan that have to be put into place. It's sort of like laying the foundation of the plan. So once you and your planner have agreed about the scope of work you're going to do together, that's when the rubber starts to hit the road. Start to gather all that information, start to make some goals. So Jim's big picture actually gives a review of this process. So we're going to go into more detail with that today.
Yeah, I want to describe the process as we get into a lot of the details and everything that goes into it. You know, the first thing that you have to do is you got to decide, are you going to do your own retirement plan? There's a lot of free software out there that have some sort of canned programs that you can use. You know, it's better than nothing. It'll give you at least a snapshot, or you might want to use the services of a qualified planner. So step one is defining the relationship that you're going to have, whoever's going to do your financial plan. Secondly, as Kathleen just talked about, you've got to gather all this information. It could be everything from pension documents, 401k programs, tax returns, company benefit programs, estate planning documents, insurance, because these are things that you're going to want to look at. Do I have the assets? Do I have the income? And also, don't forget, looking at a budget. You know, what is it really going to cost me to live? Will it change when I retire? And then once you've got all of this information, you've input it into some kind of program that your planner is working with, hopefully with you, with some input, then you take a look at some of the recommendations and you take a look at the alternatives, because there isn't one way to get to your retirement. You may have to look at alternatives such as working part-time, changing your asset mix, or delaying retirement, or maybe you're in great shape and you can retire now. And then once you develop the plan, then the plan is useless unless you implement it. That's putting the steps and priorities that have to take place, getting them into action, and then after that, it's really sitting around and monitoring the plan, because we all know life changes. You know, the markets change. I mean, if I would have told you interest rates would have been at zero 10 years ago, you would have thought I was crazy. But look at where the markets have been over the last 13 years, where interest rates are today. Look at some of the policies that we have, and look at your own life. You may change. You may live someplace else. You may be downsized, or maybe you've sort of got thrown into semi-retirement sooner than you thought. So once a plan is put into place, it's also important to monitor it. You could have health conditions change. There's a number of reasons, but it's not just enough to have a plan. You have to implement it, and then you have to monitor it.
That's right, Jim. Not only monitor, but sometimes modify it too. I want to kind of backtrack a little bit too. You know, once you have a relationship with a financial planner or software in place, you get to this point where you need to start gathering information. You know, talking about the quantity of data required, it is fairly intensive. And again, there's a reason for that. If you go into your doctor and you only fill out half of the medical history paperwork, you know, how effective is that doctor's analysis of your current health situation going to be? Not very good, because he's lacking half the information. The same thing goes with your financial planner or even your financial planning software. If you sort of skimp on the details and skip stuff and do a lot of what I call really fuzzy math or fuzzy valuations, you know, it's the whole idea of junk in, junk out. And Jim, I think a financial planning process works a lot like a checkup with a doctor. If you're thorough with your providing your medical history and what your current symptoms are, what your current concerns are with your doctor, just like with your financial plan, share with your planner what your current concerns are and current points of stress are. What they do is they look at your overall situation, your overall data, and they can identify for you the critical points you need to be thinking about, the critical things you need to be addressing. Maybe you need to figure out what your portfolio should look like. Do you need to make some changes to meet your retirement goals? Maybe you need to figure out what your retirement's going to look like in terms of your lifestyle or where you're going to live. And also, when can you actually retire? You'll cover things like maybe you need to do some tax planning, whether it's tax planning right now for your income bracket, or maybe it's some estate tax planning. Maybe those are things you need to be thinking about. And, you know, again, thinking about the medical expenses too. Maybe there's some things you need to talk about with your planner in terms of your family's medical history or your medical history that might mean that your expenses in retirement are a lot higher than normal. And Jim, again, there's just a lot of different types of data to collect. Would you mind actually talking with our listeners about some of the data they might be expected to provide to their planner or to the planning software they use?
Sure. I mean, there's a number of issues that everybody, of course, is a little bit different. Their own circumstances, health, assets that they have, different retirement packages. You know, one thing that's real helpful is to have a list, an address of phone numbers of financial advisors. Who's your CPA? Who's your attorney? Who's your broker or brokerage firms? And then also, you know, let's start with the obvious. A financial statement. What are you worth? What's the value of your assets? What's the value of your liabilities, your net worth? Then take a look at a cash flow statement. This is what I have coming in on income. This is what I'll have in expenses. Not just if you're working, but what is that going to look like when you retire? Future work possibilities. If you have a business, your tax situation, which is very important in terms of how you set up a portfolio. Existing retirement plans. It's amazing how people underutilize 401k programs. Other resources of value, patents, licenses, rents, inheritances. And take a look at time horizons. When will kids finish college? When are they going to get married? What are you anticipating as a future retirement date? Your current health, for example, longevity. What does that look like on both sides of the family? Your estate plan. And also taking a look at, you know, what your lifestyle change. Is it going to change when you retire? Are you going to stay where you are? Are you going to sell the house? Are you going to move across the country to be with the kids? Are you going to move to another state where the cost of living is cheaper and there's no taxes? So what you hope to do when you put all this data together, you hope to walk away with a couple things. You want to have a net worth. What really am I worth on paper? If I take my assets, take my liabilities, this is what I'm worth. What's your cash flow? What do you have coming in terms of income? And also, what's your tax situation? You need to know what your marginal tax bracket is, as we've covered on a previous show, because it determines how you should best invest your portfolio to minimize taxes. Because obviously, the lower taxes you pay, the more you have to keep in your pocket, the more you're going to have available for retirement. And it's not just your tax bracket today, but here's a big one. What is your tax bracket going to look like when you retire? What if you move to a tax-free state? What if your income comes in dividends, which are taxed at a lower rate? Capital gains. And when you take all this, it's important that you prioritize the goals. And those goals could be simply, you know, this is when I want to retire. This is where I want to live. This is the kind of income I'd like to have in retirement. And then when you do all that, what are going to be the steps you need to take right now? What's step 1, 2, 3 to help get you there?
And Jim, my thinking is probably pretty easy to feel a little overwhelmed about the planning process itself. But I think what you just said about prioritizing the goals is really important. Is, you know, before you even start the planning process, I think it's really important for you to sit down and really decide with you and your spouse together, figure out what is it that we want to know as the outcome from this particular process? What are the two or three things that we really have a burning need to know the answers to and focus on those things? Because the planning process goes beyond just the data collection and data analysis, we're also looking at different documents and what those documents tell us. Jim, you mentioned marginal tax rates. Providing a copy of your tax return is really important, especially if you're working with a financial planner, so they can figure out how much of your income is coming in from investments. Is it dividend income? Is it interest income? Is it taxable interest or tax-free interest? Do you have a rental income coming in? Do you have other sources of income, maybe royalties on patents, for example? Basically, figuring out what each part of your income looks like and what its tax rate is so they can help you better structure, like you were just saying, Jim, restructuring your overall investment portfolio. I'm thinking about also estate documents and what those tell us and tell us about your overall situation and your readiness as far as your estate planning is concerned. We just had a situation recently with a client who came into us with, gosh, I think it was about 20 or 25 years worth of estate documents about, you know, trusts and trusts that had split into three parts when the husband passed away. And then the trusts that were remaining that were revocable had been changed two or three times and replaced two or three times, and different types of situations where an attorney had change some information about who should be the power of attorney for the individual, and discovered some really glaring problems with the estate planning documents that were really important to be addressed by the client sooner rather than later. So again, the planning process goes beyond just the goals and the money and the data. It also talks about, you know, a broader situation in terms of, is your estate document in order? Also, if this is of a concern to you, you can also ask your planner or the software again if they'll be able to go over things like your medical expenses. Maybe you're trying to figure out what Medicare supplement plan you should be taking. Maybe you need some long-term care insurance. All these are things that your planner should be able to assist you with as part of that overall process.
And the most important part of this is the process itself, you know, because what you really want to arrive at when you're going through this, what is your number? What is the amount of assets that you're going to need to support you through not only getting you to retirement, but also through retirement? And, you know, how much income are you going to need to pull it off? a close look at expenses. You need to know these numbers and, more importantly, how they're going to change when you retire. Real expenses now and also what those expenses are going to be in the future, because we do know they will change over time, either through inflation or medical issues that will come up. You know, it was interesting because there was a government report that talked about retired Americans as a group spend less in retirement than when they were working. That would make sense, sort of. But financial and retirement counselors have also looked at this, and it's more likely that with individuals, especially those with high incomes and larger net worths, we have anecdotal evidence that suggests that these individuals maintain the same level of spending during retirement because they can afford it. And so, you know, you need to take a look at that and say, hey, will my lifestyle change? Am I going to get rid of my country club membership? Am I going to stop traveling and taking trips? Am I going to spend less time on my hobbies now that I'm retired? And so it's really important that you sort of get a feeling for that, because it will change over time. And when you add it all up, really, you're trying to say, what is that number? What do I need? And take a look at, okay, if this is my number, what are my sources of income? Can I pull it off? Do I have to delay? Do I have to work part-time? Or do I have to change some things to make this whole thing come out in a favorable outcome?
And Jim, that whole thing you just mentioned about making changes, maybe your plan is going to indicate to you that you need to make some lifestyle changes. Now, those changes may be what we call downsizing, in terms of maybe a smaller home, a cheaper state to live in. Maybe you cut out some of your hobbies and some of your spending. But you know what, Jim? We've also done plans for people where they could actually upsize in retirement. They could actually spend bigger, live larger in retirement because they've done such a good job saving. Also was thinking, Jim, too, that some of the changes you have to think about is, are you going to stay where you're living in retirement, or are you going to move? And regardless of whether you stay where you are or you're going to move, is your house going to require any sort of remodeling to make sure it's going to be comfortable for you as you get a little bit older? Do you want to stay close to your friends and family, or do you want to move to a more tax-efficient state? What about how long you're going to live and what that's going to look like? These are all things that sort of take place in terms of figuring out importance of different goals in your plan.
And the other aspect when you're putting together a retirement plan is looking at alternatives. At first pass, when you put this together, it may look like, okay, this doesn't work. But it's really important that you look at some of the alternatives. It may be it works if you delay retirement and build up assets. We know that sometimes, as you'll hear in the interview I'm going to do with the reporter from the Wall Street Journal, a lot of people begin to take their Social Security too early at age 62 because, well, number one, it's the only thing they have, which just means you're really not ready for retirement. Or number two, they think maybe it's not going to be around. And so delaying retirement to full retirement age and getting all those benefits can sometimes make the difference of additional $200,000 or $300,000 worth of additional capital. How about working part-time? Or maybe downsizing, moving to another state where the cost of living is cheaper, and in many cases where taxes are either non-existent or lower as well. And maybe it's just as simple as rearrange an investment portfolio to meet those objectives. The important thing is you've got alternatives to help get you there.
Jim, I was thinking too about some of our clients and people we're aware of that actually own their own businesses. Something that should be included in part of their planning is some sort of plan to either sell the business as they near retirement, or some kind of succession plan, whether that's some kind of key man insurance policy or some form of ownership transfer to family members or other people in the business, to have some sort of structure of passing on the business and yet somehow monetizing it for retirement. Maybe that means you figure out how much you need to sell your business for so that the proceeds can be used to support your family in retirement. You know, we've had a lot of clients that have been in a situation where they've sold a business and structured it in such a way that they were able to really maximize the dollars they got out of the business sale without paying quite so much in income tax from the sale of the business. So again, if you're a small business owner or you're someone who's a part owner in a business structure, something that's really important to keep in mind is how that's going to be passed on once something happens to you or as you retire. A great example of this is that, you know, a business isn't exactly a very liquid asset. It can take a while to sell a business or transfer ownership. So if you've got a business, something that's really important and part of your estate planning and your retirement planning is to figure out that process of ownership transfer or monetization of your business so that your plan can be complete.
Kathleen mentioned something there about taxes, and taxes play a major important role in retirement. You may be in a high tax situation during your working career. That may completely change for you in retirement, and part of it you may be able to control through either your investments or where you live. So you have to understand assets are taxed differently than, let's say, a salary or business income. You could go from a high tax bracket to a low tax bracket. For example, you could use tax-free bonds. You can move to a tax-free state, or you can go into dividends that are taxed as low as 15%. Now, one of the things you don't want to do in your planning, and especially if you're 5-10 years away, is get yourself in what I call a tax trap, where you get to retirement, your pension is taxable, your Social Security is taxable, and everything you have is in a 401k program, which you rolled over into an IRA, which is also taxable. So you have no sources of tax control other than, let's say, maybe itemized deductions. And so tax planning can be very important in terms of helping accumulate more assets for retirement, but also it can be very important in terms of minimizing your tax expense during retirement.
And Jim, I want to just bring up again, you know, how I'm always saying about brainless is painless in terms of saving for retirement, especially with your 401k plan. I'm often shocked, Jim, as I talk with people about how little they really understand their employer's retirement plan offerings in terms of the investments being offered, but also just the simple plan itself. You know, there are people out there who are completely underutilizing their plan. Maybe their employer offers a really generous match in terms of contributions, and they're not contributing themselves. So they're basically losing a significant potential match from their employer. Again, basically turning down free money from their employer every year. So just encourage all the listeners out there that if you don't feel like you have a grasp on your company's different compensation options in terms of, you know, not only your salary, but also your retirement benefits, reach out to your HR person and have them help you figure out the best way to maximize all the different offerings your work offers you in terms of your retirement planning. Make sure you're maxing out your 401k, especially if your employer is doing a match. So that helps us get you through to retirement. It's just really maximizing that 401k. Now, what about if you're basically you're at retirement? What happens then? Well, it's really important that you talk to a professional or to a tax consultant about how to handle the transition from your corporate retirement plan to an IRA rollover or maybe some kind of annuity or pension. There's tax consequences to each. There is also investment implications for each. So it's really important that before you make those decisions, once you're ready to retire and move all your assets into some sort of more personally controlled situation, that you really completely and fully understand your options here. And again, Jim, I can only say brainless is painless when it comes to retirement savings. Start early, invest regularly. And Jim, as far as, you know, what about the planning process overall? What you'll have when you're done with your process is you'll know what your number is in terms of what's your spend number. You'll know what your tax bracket is and what it might be in retirement. You should have an investment plan between now and your retirement and also post-retirement, how you're going to get to retirement and through retirement. And you also should have some sort of an idea of an estate plan and how to pass your estate on to the people and perhaps organizations that you feel pretty strongly about. And then also something else. Your plan should also cover some alternatives. What if things don't work out quite as planned? So do a little bit of testing of the plan with some worst case scenarios. Just make sure that you're ready to basically deal with whatever life might throw you.
And you know, the biggest benefit probably of all of this is you're going to know what the number is. You're going to need to retire. You're going to know what your tax bracket is. You will also have an investment plan that is more aligned with your goals to get you to retirement or get you through it if you're retired. It's very supportive of your retirement lifestyle. And more important, you'll have an investment plan that is more secure. You're not going to react to headlines or market corrections, and you'll go from a state of fear to a state of security. I'm always amazed, you know, when people get in their car, this is a summer vacation time where people are on the road taking vacation, road trips. Would you ever go on a road trip without a map or, let's say, a GPS now in your car? And also, would you go every year without going seeing your doctor and having an annual physical? But here's a surprising statistic. When it comes to retirement, 70% of Americans have no plan. In today's fast-moving, technology-driven world, you may find yourself in retirement involuntarily.
And Jim, again, we can only repeat that the biggest problem with having no plan is that having no plan is actually a plan. It's a bad plan, but it is a plan.
And I need to point out, once a plan is in place, it needs to be monitored because it needs to be flexible. It changes. Your work may change. Health may change. Goodness gracious, we know the financial markets will change. And who would have foreseen a period extended as we have? We used to look at Japan as the lost decade where they had, you know, several decades of 0% interest rates. And we used to look at them, hey, that never happened to us. Well, guess what? It has. It's been 6 years and it looks like a few more years before rates begin to rise. We've had two bear markets. And who would have thought from coming from the depths of the Great Recession in 2009, the stock market would be up over 200%. All of those occurred in a 13-year period.
Well, Jim, before we move on to a sample case study about to sort of illustrate what we've been talking about today, I just want to summarize some of the key benefits of actually putting a plan in place or having a plan. Number one, it gives you direction. It means that you know you've timelined out when different things might happen in your life. You've timelined out those costs so that you can kind of get an idea as far as the shape and feel of your future financially. Number two, it gives you numbers, actual tangible numbers that have to do with your retirement future and also your current spending patterns as well. Number three, it'll help you to know how to invest now and how to invest in the future, so you'll have a plan for your savings and for your investing. Number four, it'll make you feel a lot more secure and a lot more safe, which means that you will be a lot less prone to having anxiety attacks whenever the market goes through some sort of dramatic event. So those are some of the benefits of putting together a plan.
And maybe perhaps right now, we'll try to put this all into focus for you by discussing an actual case study that incorporates many of the things that we have just discussed, whether it's data gathering, alternative goals, taxes, moving elsewhere, all kinds of things that one has to face when you're looking at retirement, because it's never simple. A lot of things change. Work, markets, family, health, all of those things. So I thought maybe right now, Kathleen, why don't we talk about a recent case that we handled and talk about some of the complications, some of the issues that we had to deal with, and sort of illustrate the points we've been making today.
I think it's a good idea, Jim. Why don't we talk about the Tangs? A couple clients, Leo and Maddie Tang, Madeline, used to calling her Maddie. Sorry about that. Leo's about 52. Maddie's about 50. They're pretty much done raising their kids. They've got two of them, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, but they're through college, they're self-sustaining, so mom and dad aren't dipping into the pockets anymore to pay for anything for them. Leo's a petrochemical engineer at a big energy company out in Connecticut, and Maddie, you know, she's in a situation in life where she's raised her kids, and she's got enough income coming in from her husband, so she's working at a jewelry boutique part-time just for fun as a way to keep herself occupied and keep her from going too stir-crazy. When they came to us, they had a couple of concerns. And these, again, these are what I call having quality problems. Number one, they were just sort of thinking that there's got to be a better way for them to manage their income to make it more tax efficient. You know, Leo had been at this energy company for a very, very long time, really a senior executive there now, doing very, very well for himself, earning a nice, healthy six-figure salary, close to the highest tax bracket, although not quite there. And so how do they reduce that income now? And then looking ahead to retirement, Leo was in a situation where his company had a deferred compensation plan, which meant he could put off taking some of his income until later on. And as things stand right now, when they first came to us, he had about $1 million in deferred compensation set aside. And if he were to take that compensation over a period of 5 years, the payout would be $200,000 a year. If you took it over a period of 10 years, it'd be $100,000 a year. And so that's $100,000 to $200,000 worth of income coming in that would be taxable at retirement. And his 401k required minimum distributions would kick in when he was 70 and a half. Right now, his 401k is around $2 million. Could be a lot more than that by retirement, looking at least $60,000 or more in required minimum distribution amounts at 70 and a half. So he's looking at a potential income in retirement between, you know, $160,000 and $260,000, not to mention their rental income that they were planning on renting out their primary residence when they retired. You start adding all that in together, and they could see a tax problem sort of coming down the pike, so to speak, as they were approaching retirement. Those kind of their first concern is, are we being tax efficient now? And how do we plan to be more tax efficient when we have all this income coming in when we retire? Their second concern was about passing their assets on to their children. They really have no estate plan right now, and we're getting concerned about that, especially because where they live in the state of Connecticut. There's actually an estate tax of 7.2 to 12%, depending on the estate size, for estates over $2 million, which obviously their estate would count for that. And so that was a big concern for them. What's the best way for us to structure our assets now in our estate to avoid these estate taxes or minimize those? Something else when it comes to estate planning, and this was a big bone of contention for Leo and his extended family. Leo's dad had died a few years ago, and his mom remarried someone that none of the family like. He and his siblings just can't stand this guy. They think he's a freeloader with their mom, and they really just don't care for him very much. Now, the problem is that his mom was left very well off by his father. He left her a lot of money. He left her a really, really fantastic traditional Asian art collection. And so she's got a fairly high net worth and absolutely no estate plan. The problem is she's living in an estate where, because she's married to this new individual, her spouse could end up with her entire estate if she dies because she doesn't have any estate plan whatsoever. And another problem is, what if she does do an estate plan and appoints him as the executor? Boy, is that going to cause fur to fly with the kids. And the last thing they were thinking about is, you know, we know we've saved a lot of money, and is it time for us to retire soon? You know, Leo's 52. Should we retire at age 60? Maybe 65? You know, Leo really loves his job. Maybe he can push it to age 70. So when should we start timelining our preparation for retirement? Are we almost there, or are we really far away from that? So those are some of the sort of the issues that Leo and Maddie were concerned about when they came in to talk to us.
And let's take a look at where they were from an asset point of view. I mean, they were very good shape. They lived well beyond their means, had lots of savings, and especially with the way compensation was structured at the company, plus his own salary. We look at their house was worth about $600,000, $300,000 mortgage, less than 3%, locked in on low rates when they refinanced, so not a major issue here given the net worth. They had an art collection and no plans to sell, roughly about $300,000. Now let's look at the liquid assets, and most of them, and you'll understand as we get into the plan about tax issues, 401k program, $2 million could get bigger depending on how long Leo decided to work. Deferred comp, $1 million, as Kathleen talked about, with two options paid out over 5 years or 10 years. Alternative investments, roughly about $200,000. Brokerage account, roughly about close to $1 million. Checking, which was a little bit high, $200,000. And precious metals, physical, kept in a bank deposit of roughly about $50,000. They live on $100,000 a year, no debt other than mortgage, which is why they have the net worth that they do.
So this is actually a really great couple, Jim. I mean, they've done really well for themselves. They've done a lot, a really good job saving, a really good job keeping their expenses down, living way below their means, just doing a really great job financially. But again, one of their main concerns is, gosh, we're paying so much in income tax. What do we do? So what about their taxable income right now? One of the issues is just this tension between reducing taxable income now versus reducing taxable income later. So we looked at Leo's 401k at work. Now, Leo's 401k, like a lot of 401ks now, actually offered two different 401k options, a traditional 401k contribution as well as a Roth 401k contribution. And there are situations where if your deferred compensation is pretty big and your 401k is already pretty big, where adding to a Roth 401k instead of a traditional 401k would actually be better for you given your tax bracket at retirement. So you would take the tax hit up front now with the assumption that your tax bracket in retirement was going to be even bigger than your tax bracket right now. So we reviewed that situation with the Tangs because, again, Leo did have a fairly sizable amount that was going to start becoming taxable in retirement. We determined that in his particular case, it was actually okay for him to keep making traditional 401k contributions, really maxing out his 401k contributions, especially because his employer had a really generous match, 100% match up until the contribution reached 7% of his salary. So that's a pretty generous match program. We also encouraged him to remember to bump up his contributions when he reached age 55. Make those contributions even bigger. His employer was also doing a really nice profit sharing program. So just really encouraged him to keep contributing to his 401k and going ahead and doing it through traditional 401k rather than Roth 401k options. We also reminded him to do his best to maximize his deferred compensation contributions, to go ahead and keep putting off those income taxes. Also, he's getting to the point in his career where he's going to become close to where his HR department's going to start reaching out to him and saying, okay, we need you to make an election now as far as when you retire, if you're going to expect us to pay you out with your deferred compensation over a period of 5 years or a period of 10 years. And given how much he'd already pushed off until retirement for his deferred compensation, we encouraged him to choose the 10-year option rather than the 5-year option when that option presented itself to him. And the last thing we encouraged them to do is they were open to the idea of relocating in retirement. Again, they were thinking about maybe moving to New Mexico or, you know, a couple other states that have Washington State that have lower tax brackets. Really encouraged them to consider doing that, but to make sure that they actually vet those locations first, spend some really good long extended vacation time out at those places to make sure that they're happy with the culture and the people there and the environment and the weather. Also, as they're thinking about relocating, to not forget things like accessibility to health care, also the convenience of the home in terms of, you know, getting a little bit older, access to entertainment, services, shopping. That if you're going to be making a move of that size, just to make sure that you make a move that's smart and it's going to be a good one for you as you keep getting a little bit older.
Then we wanted to look at their estate plan. And as mentioned earlier, as a resident of Connecticut, Connecticut had a 7.2% tax rate all the way up to 12% on assets over $2 million. So determining an estate to live in where not only the income taxes were low or non-existent, and also no estate taxes. And that is still up in the air. There's three or four candidates. We encouraged them, which they did, set up a trust and then also to modify that trust. As we know, right now it's fairly stable. But there was a period of time leading up to 2010 and then actually 2013 when we really didn't know what the estate tax rates were going to be and what the exemption was. So we set up a trust. The other thing, too, is we wanted them to get their artwork valued and inventoried. I mean, the kids aren't really interested in it, and they may want to consider, through their estate plan, gifting the art to a museum or institution, or making sure a successor trustee is knowledgeable about art and comfortable with an art auction or sale process. We also encourage them to talk to Leo's mom about a trust, similar considerations for her own artwork, which were nice and considerable, and an A-B split with some to the husband, some to the kids, and the kids will inherit all. But also, more importantly, to consider a professional trustee or a fiduciary as a successor trustee to avoid all the drama, and especially with a husband that people weren't really fond of, and especially with Leo's brothers and sisters. So it was rather complex in terms of getting his mom to think about these issues, but then also to get the Tangs to think about, you know, where were they going to locate? Because there were two issues. There was lifestyle. What would it cost to buy a home? What would the income taxes in the estate be? And now, considering that they have a high amount of assets in what I call deferred assets, whether deferred comp or an IRA with the company, that estate taxes were very important, especially in Connecticut when they start at $2 million.
And again, Jim, I think, you know, especially when it comes to estate planning, really important for them to talk to Leo's mom about specifically how to structure her trust. You know, does she do an A-B trust split? Does she leave everything to the husband, everything to the kids? Just to make sure that her mom's wishes for her estate are really being taken into account there. And another big question they had, Jim, was, you know they've done a good job saving. They're fairly comfortable with their financial situation right now. And they're just sort of asking themselves, you know, how long does Leo need to really keep working? Can he retire a little bit younger, or should he keep working until he's 65 or 70, or can he retire when he's 60 in 8 years? And so we looked at their numbers, and they've got, you know, a pretty modest amount of expenditures, you know, $100,000 a year, which could possibly go down if they move to another lower tax state, lower expense state in retirement. They're in really, really good financial shape. So we looked at the situation with them between their Social Security, between Leo's deferred compensation that would start paying out when he was age 65, if that was when he retired, plus his required minimum distributions, plus their rental income, all that income combined together is going to be way more than they need for their expenses, you know, regardless of when Leo retires. He could retire at age 60 and be fine, age 65 and be fine, age 70 and be fine. So he's got a really great situation for himself. His problem is really more about, how much do I love my job? Now, Leo's in a really unique situation. He happens to be in an industry where there is a shortage of what they call gray hair. There's a shortage of people who have been around for a really long time. And so people around him are just retiring right and left. And so he keeps being offered more and more increasing responsibility and increasing salaries over time because the company just really requires his level of expertise. So he's thinking, you know what, if this keeps up like this, I might work till I'm 70. Loves his job, no reason to leave it early, very happy with what he does. So, you know, we told him, you know, Leo, if you want to retire at 60, you can. Right now he's thinking, you know, it's nice to know I can do that if I need to, but I'm liking my job so much and things are going so well there right now with all my opportunities with everyone else retiring. I'm going to hang out here as long as I can.
And the other thing we did on the investment side, there were some alternative investments which were highly illiquid. They really weren't providing anything in means of diversification of assets or exposure. So we recommended when the open window comes up on these investments, they were hedge funds, and especially these particular hedge funds and the way they were invested, that they would liquidate over time. The other thing is transfer 3/4 of their taxable accounts to dividend payers, which would be taxed at the lower tax bracket, in Leo's bracket with itemized deductions and deferred comp. He was just a tad below the 450 level of taxable income, which he would kick him up into the Obama tax, so the dividends would be taxed at a lower rate than interest income and bonds, plus long-term capital gains and blue-chip type stocks that can increase those dividends. And we kept 6 months of expenses in the bank because they had a lot of money, which removed about $150,000 from checking, and that was just a matter of issue of sort of a parking place to figure out what they wanted to do with it, and then transition 1/4 of their taxable accounts into laddered bonds on the tax-free side to keep the taxes down to a minimum. And the other thing that we would do is as he got into retirement at age 70 and a half, where he would have to begin taking mandatory distributions from his retirement plan, we would just simply offset his taxable income by moving more of his income to tax-free bonds. So this is an example of all the type of issues that you can deal with, everything from estate planning to income taxes, how to contribute to plans, deferred compensation, dealing with, you know, sometimes parents and their estate plan, the issues of a second marriage. So quite a bit of it. And also on the estate planning side of avoiding estate taxes, especially when you don't have to pay them. You can just move someplace else where they don't tax you. It's that simple.
And Jim, again, I think the Tings are a great example of a pretty broad spectrum of concerns and questions that were answered through the planning process. And again, I think it's worth noting here that the Tings have a lot of flexibility so that they're welcome to come back to us and revise the plan anytime. Maybe they do decide to go ahead and retire at 60. So they want to come to us when maybe Leo's 58, 59, just to make sure that they're still on track, they're still good to go. So again, the beauty of having a plan in place, it's a lot easier to tweak than to start from scratch. So once you've got the plan in place, it's really easy to tweak it and tinker with it and make changes if necessary. The most important thing, Jim, is again, just to get started on the process, get yourself a plan. Coming up next here on Financial Sense Newswire's Lifetime Income Program, Jim talks with Jonathan Clements, contributor to the Wall Street Journal, about three big questions, three big problems you might have in retirement you need to think about before you sign on any dotted lines. That's coming up after this.
One of the biggest decisions you'll make towards the end of your career is making that decision to retire. For some, it'll be voluntary. For others, it'll be involuntary. And there are a lot of things that go into making that decision. And sometimes, if not done properly, those decisions could be fatal. Joining us on the program is Jonathan Clements from the Wall Street Journal. And Jonathan, I want to talk about your recent article, You're Ready for Retirement, but Your Savings Aren't. Now, one of the trends in this country, as you talk about in your article, 45% of men and 51% of women are claiming their Social Security benefits at age 62. That could be a fatal mistake. Let's talk about why that could be so.
First of all, let's talk about why people take it early at age 62. And I think there are probably two reasons that drive that decision. One, people simply do not have enough saved. And the only way they can retire at age 62 is to claim Social Security right away. Well, my immediate response to that is, if the only way you can retire at age 62 is by claiming Social Security right away, then you don't have enough money to retire. If you're that strapped that you have to claim Social Security right away, clearly you have not done a good job of saving for retirement, and you should probably try to stay in the workforce for a little bit longer or consider working part-time in retirement. And I think the second reason a lot of people claim Social Security at age 62, the earliest possible age, is because they fear that the Social Security system is going to go under. They've heard all this thing about, you know, the Social Security Trust Fund, how it's going to run out of money, blah, 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 blah. No politician hoping to be reelected is going to cut benefits for existing retirees. The chance that you're in your 60s or later and suddenly the government's going to come along and take away your Social Security benefits, the odds are de minimis. It's a terrible reason to decide to claim Social Security early out of that fear.
Yeah, because that's something that you and I were talking before we went on the air. And our listeners, just think about this. Think of all the politicians that will be running on slogans for their reelection campaign this fall. Can you imagine any one of your local politicians running on the platform, "If you elect me, I'll do away with your Social Security"? I just don't see that.
It isn't going to happen.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
So that raises the question, Mike, why should you delay Social Security? Why shouldn't you take it at 62, and why should you instead delay to 66 or until age 70? Well, first of all, look at the numbers. If you delay Social Security from age 62 to as late as age 70, which is the latest possible age which you claim Social Security, you will increase your benefit, excluding any adjustments for inflation, by 76 or 77%. So you get a huge increase in Social Security by delaying. And moreover, that income stream is hugely valuable. I mean, you're going to get it for the rest of your life. It's at least partially tax-free. It's government guaranteed. And if you die, your spouse can potentially get your benefit as a survivor benefit. For all those reasons, it makes great sense, particularly if you're the family's maiden breadwinner, it makes great sense to delay Social Security. I mean, the only situation that I could envisage claiming Social Security at age 62 is if both you and your spouse are in terrible health. If that's the case, then yes, claim Social Security early. But otherwise, if your health is reasonable, and if you're married, if both your health is reasonable, then it makes sense to delay.
You know, you gave an example of somebody taking their Social Security at age 62. They take a 25% hit. In this case, they would get $1,050 a month or $12,600 a year. If they delayed the benefits from 66 to age 70, they would get a lot more. And if they waited to age 70, they would get $1,848. Now, that's almost $800 a month. And if you divide that by 3%, now here's something in this kind of market that really stands out. That's the equivalent of having over $300,000 of capital to produce that extra income. I don't think people realize how powerful an argument that is for to delay when you think of it in terms of how much would I have in savings to replace what I would get by waiting longer.
One of the other reasons that I think people end up taking Social Security early is because there's some confusion about what life expectancies are. A lot of people will look at life expectancies as of birth and say, well, you know, I'm only expected to live until my late 70s. But if you want to get an accurate sense of what your life expectancy is, what you need to do is to look at your life expectancy as of age 65. Because life expectancy as of age 65 is substantially greater than life expectancy as of birth, because those figures for life expectancy as of birth reflect all the people who die early in life, in accidents, crimes, whatever it is, people who suffer cancer early in their lives. So if you look at life expectancy as of age 65, if you're a woman, you can expect to live until age 87. And if you're a man, you can expect to live until age 85. You have to remember that those are simply averages, so half of people are going to live longer than that. Moreover, if you're married, you have two tickets to the life expectancy lottery. And the figures indicate that if you're a couple and you're age 65, there's a 50% chance that one of you will live to age 90. So claiming early so you get that check right away, because you could potentially live so long, it could turn out to be a fatal mistake.
Jonathan, what about the idea that, as you allude to your article, let's say that if you have to claim it early, at age 62, you may not be ready for retirement because you don't have enough savings. Let's talk about some alternatives, which is either to work longer in your existing job or work part-time. And then also, let's talk about, you know, maybe you wait to age 66 and you have your spouse claim part of your Social Security so she gets it, but you continue to work. Let's talk about those options, because I think a lot of people don't realize that they have some alternatives if they find themselves in that predicament.
So let's talk about a couple of numbers that came out of the Employee Benefit Research Institute. They do this annual survey, the Retirement Confidence Survey. The 2014 survey indicates that people expect to retire at age 65, but in fact, they typically end up retiring at age 62. So why do they end up retiring 3 years earlier? Well, in some cases, you know, they retire early because they are in ill health and they figure that they might as well retire now and enjoy some sort of retirement. But often, they end up retiring earlier because they're forced out of the workforce. There are layoffs, the business they work for closes down, whatever the reason is, they end up out of work at age 62. And I think that's the reason a lot of people turn around and claim Social Security. But if you're in that situation, just because you've retired at age 62 doesn't mean you should immediately claim Social Security. And indeed, if you're not in great financial shape, one of the things you might want to do is think about working part-time. A lot of financial experts these days talk about a 4% portfolio withdrawal rate. So let's say you could get a part-time job that pays you $16,000 a year. Earning $16,000 a year working part-time in retirement is like having a nest egg that is $400,000 larger based on that 4% withdrawal rate. So working part-time in retirement could be a way to help you postpone claiming Social Security. It can help you postpone starting to draw down your nest egg. And in the meantime, working part-time can also actually give a sense of purpose to your retirement. I mean, one of the things that always surprises me is people spend years preparing financially for retirement, but they don't actually give much thought to what they're going to do once they get there. You know, we have this vague notion that, you know, once we get to retirement, we're going to rest and relax. Well, you know, a couple of weeks into retirement, you're probably going to be pretty well rested. So what are you going to do then? What's going to get you out of bed in the morning? And working part-time in retirement can give you that sense of purpose. It could be the raison d'etre for your retirement. And by going to work every couple of days a week, you know, you're going to get that sort of physical stimulation, that social stimulation, that intellectual stimulation that we all need.
And this is something that I have several clients. One was a doctor, one was a editor at a publishing company. They retired, and then the one of them became a guide at the Hearst Castle because they moved there, they liked it, and he enjoyed it so much. And he found it very fulfilling, meeting people from around the world. And as you mentioned, it can keep you stimulated, which can also help you live longer, but also it can be very fulfilling.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we know is that the rate of depression among retirees is higher than the national average, and the rate of suicide among retirees is higher than the national average. If you're not careful about planning your retirement, not just financially, but in terms of how you're going to spend your days, you could find that retirement is a massive disappointment. I mean, you know, playing golf every day will not give a sense of purpose to your retirement. Watching TV and going out to lunch with friends is not going to give a sense of purpose to your retirement. That's why the retirees who seem to have the best time are those who volunteer. They're helping the local schools. They go back to college and they take college courses. They get more involved with their religion. They take up new hobbies. We tend to be happiest when we're engaged in activities that we think are important, that we're passionate about, that we find challenging, that we think we're good at. And what you want in your retirement is to be able to do something that fits those criteria. And if you have that and you can get paid for it, that's all the better.
Jonathan, let's talk about a possible option, too, where one spouse, let's say the woman, takes her Social Security based on part of her husband's. Let's talk about that option.
Well, let's say that your full retirement age is age 66. So for everybody who's approaching retirement age, they should know there are these three key ages. There's age 62, the earliest age at which you can claim benefits. There's your full retirement age, which is going to be either 66 or 67. And then there is age 70, which is the latest at which you can claim Social Security. If you are the family's main breadwinner, you have this option once you reach your full retirement age of age 66 or age 67 to do something called file and suspend, which is you file for benefits, but then you immediately suspend benefits. By filing and suspending, what you allow your spouse to do is to claim spousal benefits. And those spousal benefits could be worth as much as half of your benefit as of your full retirement age. So for instance, going back to the numbers, Jim, that you were mentioning earlier in the show, the typical monthly benefit as of full retirement age is $1,400 a month. So if you're the family's main breadwinner and you're entitled to $1,400 a month as of your full retirement age of 66 or 67, your spouse could get as much as $700 a month in spousal benefits. So if you want to try to maximize your Social Security benefits as a couple at full retirement age, you can file for your file and suspend. That'll allow your spouse to claim spousal benefits. And meanwhile, you can delay your benefit to age 70 so that you get the maximum monthly benefit. And also, assuming you predecease your spouse, ensure the maximum survivor benefit for your spouse.
Let's move on and assume that, all right, you're heading into retirement. Let's talk about some big decisions you should really make in terms of heading into retirement. And one of them, you talk about where we are in the market cycle, because there's a lot of, as you know, cookie cutter formulas for retirement in terms of how you should invest based on your age. You have so much in fixed income, so much in, let's say, equities. But suppose, Jonathan, that you took your retirement January 1st of 2008. Those kind of decisions where the market cycle was then are much different and could have altered your retirement dramatically.
What you're raising here, Jim, is a really crucial issue. And it's captured by this notion of sequence of return risk. So what's sequence of return risk? It's this problem that can afflict retirees if they retire and they're immediately hit by a terrible down market like we saw in 2008 and into 2009. You know, if you're still in the workforce, you know, a down market can be unpleasant, but if anything, you get to take advantage of it because you're still got a paycheck coming in, and if you're contributing to your 401k plan or to your IRA, that down market allows you to buy securities at depressed prices, which is what you want to do as an investor. But if you're a retiree, the world looks totally different. If the market goes down, not only is your portfolio shrinking in size, but also you may have to sell some of your stocks in order to cover grocery bills. So in a sense, you're getting a double hit. Not only is the market going down, but also you're reducing the size of your nest egg with your own withdrawals. That double whammy can do severe damage to a portfolio, particularly if you get hit with one of those big market declines early in retirement, because on the day you retire, your nest egg is going to be close to the largest it's ever going to be. So a big market decline is going to cost you a lot of dollars. Throw your own withdrawals on top of that, and you could see your portfolio badly beaten up in the first 2 or 3 years, and thereafter you're going to have to readjust your spending, and you may find that you can't have the retirement lifestyle that you wanted.
You know, let's talk about, too, tax issues, because a lot of times retirees will get themselves in a situation where they retire, and let's say their main sources of income are going to be their pension, their Social Security, and let's say they had some kind of savings, a deferred savings program at work, a 403b plan, 457, or a 401k plan, which they roll over to an IRA. So when they retire, Jonathan, every source of income possible that they have is 100% taxable, and they get themselves in what is called almost like a permanent tax situation, like an employee working at a company with no tax deductions.
Yeah, I mean, taxes are a crucial issue for retirees, but also one of the great things about being retired is you have greater control over your income, and so you can actually be very smart about managing your tax bill. So, you know, Jim, you outlined all those potential sources of income. You know, you've got your Social Security, maybe you have a traditional company pension, you have this money in retirement accounts, much of which when it comes out is going to be taxed as ordinary income. And then you may have sources of income that will involve little or no tax, like you might have some money in a Roth IRA, or you might have cash sitting in a regular taxable account, say in a savings account where there's no tax bill when you pull the money out of that account. So what you see with some retirees is they retire, they haven't started their traditional company pension, or maybe they don't have it, they haven't yet claimed Social Security, and they decided that, you know, they're going to put off touching their retirement accounts for as long as possible so they continue to get the tax-deferred growth, which is generally a pretty good idea. So what they're going to do to cover their initial years in retirement is they're going to draw down their savings account. And lo and behold, they end up paying zero in taxes, which sounds like a wonderful situation. But what it really is a wasted opportunity. If you have a year where you're likely to have little or no taxable income, you may actually want to think about, how can I increase my taxable income this year, knowing that if I don't, I may have to pay bigger tax bills down the road when I do, say, start drawing down my IRA or my 401k. So in your 60s, particularly, And particularly if you know you don't have a traditional company pension and you are delaying Social Security, you can start to look at strategies like converting part of your regular IRA to a Roth IRA. You'll pay taxes on the taxable sum converted, but thereafter, your regular traditional retirement account is going to be smaller, and that may mean smaller tax bills down the road, say once you turn age 70 and you have to start taking required minimum distributions.
You know, this is something that we always try to encourage our clients is build up a dual savings program. Not only, you know, take advantage of any kind of deferred savings program they have at work, and especially if you have an employer that's matching those contributions, because obviously you're building a bigger net worth, but also to have a personal savings program. Because, for example, Jonathan, as you know, at age 70 and a half, you have to take mandatory distributions from your IRA. So now that you're required to do that, you have more taxable income. If you have personal savings, you can shift over part of your portfolio into, let's say, tax-free bonds or stocks like real estate investment trust or pipeline companies that are tax sheltered, so you can offset the taxes, meaning that the more income you have, you're keeping it. And that's the flexibility, I think, that sometimes people forget to incorporate in their planning, and it boxes them in a corner, and you don't want to be that way.
Yeah, as I said, retirees, unlike those of us who are still in the workforce, have great flexibility to vary their taxable income from one year to the next, particularly when they're in their 60s before they have to start taking the required minimum distributions from those IRAs. And so you should take advantage of that. For instance, supposing you have a year with very large medical expenses, and so you've got this large tax deduction. Well, that might be a year when you take out extra money from your IRA. Conversely, maybe there is a year when you have to put a new roof on the house, or you need to buy a new car. Well, if you pay for that by pulling money out of your IRA, you may push yourself into a higher tax bracket. So that might be the year when instead you take some money from the Roth IRA or you take some money from that regular savings account. And that way you don't push yourself into that higher tax bracket.
Let's talk about something else that I think plays a big role in terms of how a portfolio should set up. And what we encourage, Jonathan, is for people considering retirement, first of all, they come up with a budget, and they break that budget into several categories. And the most important one is their fixed living cost. This is what it costs them to live. This is what their health insurance premiums are, their utility bills, maybe a house payment if they have one, fixed costs, food bills, gasoline, those kind of things, so that you know. And what you want is predictable sources of income, like a pension, Social Security, maybe a fixed income portfolio, so that no matter what's going on in the headline news, you know the income coming in is going to cover those fixed costs. That way you can better plan what kind of portfolio is going to meet your retirement objectives.
You know, I think that's a great point, Jim. So yeah, everybody can take their monthly spending and divide what they're spending each month between fixed costs, those things that you mentioned, you know, the insurance premiums, the property taxes, the grocery bills, the utilities, and stuff like that. And then there's discretionary expenses, which is the fun stuff, you know, going out to dinner, taking a vacation, going to the theater. So what you want to know is of your monthly spending, how much is going towards those fixed costs? And then you may want to set up a portfolio where you can cover those fixed costs with what you're receiving from Social Security, what you're receiving from a traditional pension, maybe the dividends from your stocks and the interest from your bonds. And then if that's not quite enough to cover those fixed costs, you might want to keep a cash reserve that you can draw on to pay those additional expenses each month in case the market does go down and you can't create your own dividends by, say, selling some of your stocks.
Let's talk about, and this gets back to something we began talking about, when you retire, looking at where the market conditions are. And a lot of, Jonathan, individuals, because of the financial crisis in 2008, following the crashing of the tech bubble in 2001, the downturn in real estate, they've gone all into one area of the market. A lot of money has flowed into bond funds, and as interest rates came down, those dividends have been reduced. Let's talk about the importance of diversification and, like it or not, having some dividend-paying stocks or a dividend-paying mutual fund is very good long-term for your retirement, because where else are you going to get increasing sources of income as you retire?
As an investor, the number one virtue is humility. You need to look in the mirror and say to yourself, I have no idea what is going to happen. So if you have no idea what's going to happen in the financial markets, what are you going to do? Well, what you should do is own a little bit of everything. So you shouldn't be going all bonds or all cash or all stocks, because you simply don't know which of these areas of the market is going to perform best. You may lean one way or another. You may decide the bonds are a little overpriced, so you'll have a little bit more in stocks. But going from all stocks to all bonds to all cash, nobody has a crystal ball that can allow them to do that. So, yes, you need to own a little bit of everything. And particularly as a retiree, you know, back in the day, people used to retire at age 65, and they weren't expected to live that much longer, so it wasn't so risky to take your money and put it all in bonds and try to live off the interest. But today, if you retire at age 65, we were talking about life expectancies earlier, if you're a man, you might live to age 85 on average, and a woman to age 87, and there's a good likelihood that you're going to live into your 90s. That is plenty of time for inflation to ravage the spending power of the interest that you receive from your bonds. But fortunately, it's also plenty of time to ride out some stock market ups and downs and earn gains that outpace inflation. So if you're thinking about the long term and wanting to make sure that you have enough money when you get into your late 70s and early 80s and you're not left behind by rising inflation, you should probably be keeping part of your portfolio in stocks.
You know, one thing that's really important to point out, too, and especially if you are, let's say, investing in some blue chip stocks or blue chip dividend fund, you know, if you owned Coca-Cola, Jonathan, in 2008, Coca-Cola stock went down with the market, but they didn't emit their dividend. In fact, during the financial crisis, Coca-Cola increased its dividend 8% in 2008 and another 8% in 2009. So, number one, even though the stock went down, your income, which is really what you're counting on in retirement, was never disrupted, and you got a pay increase.
Yeah, I mean, Coca-Cola is sort of an exception. I mean, in 2008 and into 2009, a lot of companies did cut their dividends. But the one thing, to your point, Jim, is even though dividends did decline for most companies during the financial crisis, they declined far less than underlying share prices. Dividends overall for the market fell something over 20%, but the S&P 500 was down 57%. So dividends are far less volatile than share prices, and moreover, they do tend to rise over time, and they tend to rise faster than inflation. So if you want an income stream that increases over time and protects you against inflation, owning dividend-paying stocks is a great strategy.
And also, you know, one of the things that you pointed out as we kind of summarize here, if there's anything that's kind of clear that comes out of this, if you are taking retirement or your Social Security at age 62 because you have no other source of income, that's really an indication that you really don't have the savings to retire. So you might want to consider doing something part-time, maybe continuing on in your job even though you wanted to retire at age 62. And, you know, Jonathan, I have clients who, you know, were well off at the time they retired, but they wanted to get that extra assurance that they really had enough to take care of them because, as you pointed out, you know, the longer you live, your life expectancy increases. And they found very fulfilling as part of their life to continue doing something part-time.
And that's certainly my retirement plan. I mean, I hope never to fully retire. I mean, fortunately, I do something, you know, I write for a living that I am able to do on a part-time basis, and I should be able to do, you know, late in life. But most of us should be able to find something that we are able to do that's not too physically strenuous later in life, that can keep our mind active, can keep us physically active, can give us that social stimulation that we all need. I think working a couple of days in retirement is a great idea.
Jonathan, as we close, you write a lot of articles for the Wall Street Journal, but you also have your own website. If our listeners would like to follow your work, which has been very helpful, I think, in getting people to think about their investments and retirement, why don't you give out your website as we close?
Sure. My personal website is jonathanclements.com, and I update the website occasionally. In addition to writing for the journal, the other big thing that I'm working on right now is I have a major personal finance guide that will be appearing at the beginning of 2015. It's probably the biggest writing project I've ever taken on, and that is actually consuming more than half of my time right now.
Well, we'll look forward to that, and please notify us when that comes about. We'd love to have you back on the program, and keep up the great work. Some great, great articles, folks. If you have a chance, go to Jonathan's website, or you can follow him in the Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks, Jim. It's been my pleasure.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.